Good. Well, we have been exploring through Ezra together. And tonight we get to Ezra. And again, apologies to any Panamanians, but it's the reference is 6:1. That's where we're at. Ezra 6:1. Okay. So, but before we dive in to Ezra 6:1, let's just think about the story so far. So the story so far is this. The people of Israel have been rejecting God. Of course, before they were brought out of Egypt, they've been in Egypt for 400 years. And under the leadership of Moses and Aaron, they were brought out of Egypt. And that was a wonderful homecoming. But those people, they kept rebelling and rejecting God. And I've been reading Jeremiah recently in my quiet times. And Jeremiah warns them again and again that, look, you're going to be taken away. You're going to go into captivity. He warns them 70 years you're going to go unless you repent. And the people didn't repent. And so God sent Nebuchadnezzar, who brought them into captivity. It should have been the end of the story, except that God had promised in places like Jeremiah 29:11, I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not to harm you. One day Daniel was in one of his having a quiet time, and he was reading Jeremiah. And as he read Jeremiah, he saw that God had promised 70 years. And so when he sees that promise, he starts to pray fervently that God would bring the people home again. And then the book of Ezra begins, and in chapter 1, verse 1, we meet Zerubbabel and Jeshua. Zerubbabel, the prince, descendant of David, and Jeshua, the high priest. And under their leadership, because God has moved the heart of the new king, a new king has arrived, the king who's leading the Medes and the Persians. And under this new king, he says that the Israelites can go home and rebuild the temple. And it's 70 years. And so the first part is the people going home. Heading home, another homecoming. In fact, Jeremiah said, you used to be called the people who God led out of Egypt, brought home from Egypt, but you'll be called those who God brought home from Babylon, because the miracle is so tremendous that God would bring the people home from Babylon. And the people make this dangerous journey. Psalms like Psalm 126 are written. As the nations watch the nation of Israel go past, our psalm for the year, the Lord has done great things for them, they say. Yes, the Lord has done great things for us, and we are filled with joy. And they arrive, and they start building the temple. The people have come home. But then opposition comes. And we've been seeing together how there was infiltration, discouragement, violence to try to stop the people building. And sure enough, the building stops. It's kind of heartbreaking as we read to that point. And the people, well, they decide, well, what should we do? You know, it's not the time really to build God's temple, is it? So they went to their own houses and they started putting wooden panels up in their own houses and making them luxurious and comfortable. And meanwhile, the temple of God was a ruin. And that's why, as we were hearing last week, the prophet Haggai quotes God and says, look, why are you living in your paneled houses when my house remains a ruin? Of course, the concern of God, as it is through the generations, is for the heart of the people. That's what God is concerned about. It's not the state of architecture, but it's that their hearts have turned against God. And God has the same concern, even tonight, for us. He's not so concerned on the architecture up the road, but he loves you and he's concerned for our hearts. But there's a revolution there in Haggai, and after 24 days, the people, their direction is completely changed. And now, they're instead of living half-hearted, disappointed, unsatisfied lives, instead, they end up, they are inspired. The Lord stirs their spirit, it says in Haggai chapter 1. They're inspired people, and they turn to that ruined temple, and they start to build again. And what we can see by what they're doing is that their hearts have changed. They've turned back to God. They're concerned for His glory and not for their comfort. But now, as we were hearing last week, opposition comes again. And these authoritarian people turn up in chapter 5 and they start asking serious questions. And they say, who has authorized you to do this? This is now in Ezra chapter 5 and verse 3. He says this in Ezra chapter 5 and verse 3. Who authorized you to rebuild the temple? And in verse 4, what are the names of the building, of the men constructing this building? But the people, despite this pressure, and despite the opposition, the same kind of opposition that stopped them last time, this time they carry on. This time they have courage because they've been stirred by the Spirit of God and they press on into the work. They are different people because God has changed their hearts. An echo of what we were looking at together this morning. And so, as we heard last week, a letter is sent. Probably didn't look like this one. But this letter is taken. There was a great infrastructure in that empire, and they would have ridden with a horse with this question. Should they be building or not? And I'm sure that that letter was sent because those who were asking the question were certain that the answer would be no. Stop them. Stop them from doing that. Because that was the instruction they'd had previously. And of course, the people, they carried on building, but every day they thought any moment now there's going to be a chariot coming over the hill, followed by heaps of chariots as the superpower of the day comes over the hills to crush us. And if a chariot doesn't sound too intimidating, well, really, that's a tank in our language. And so dangerous situation. And the question on everyone's heart is, well, what is going to happen? What is God going to do? Are we going to be destroyed in a few days' time? I find this moment between chapter 5 and chapter 6, really encouraging and inspiring. Because it's like many of our moments, like probably for many of us tonight, right now, right here. As we question, in the middle of a story, what is God going to do? What is going to happen next? These people were so courageous because they've been inspired by God's Spirit that they said, well, we would rather die. We would rather die than go back to that mundane TikTok life of just trying to live for our own little lives. We want to live for the future of God's kingdom, whatever the cost. And that's the state of the people's hearts as chapter 5 closes and we're left in suspense for months. But at this moment, Haggai speaks. And before we look at chapter 6, let's turn to Haggai chapter 2 and just read three verses. Haggai chapter 2, and we'll read actually just two. Verses 4 to 5. Now, if you have trouble finding Haggai, we found it last week, but you could go to Matthew and then just rewind until you bump into it. It's only a page long, so it's easy to miss, but it's right up close to Matthew. And Haggai, as we heard last week, is speaking and is prophesying into this situation of the people. And Haggai says four things to the people. And it's worth us reading it at this moment, because then the impact of chapter 6 is all the stronger. So verse 4, this is when people are saying, oh, it's nothing. Verse 4, be strong, O Zerubbabel, declares the Lord. Be strong, O Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Be strong, all you people of the land, declares the Lord, and work. "For I am with you, declares the Lord Almighty. This is what I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, and my spirit remains among you. Do not fear." What a message. You know, these people were wondering whether the chariots were about to come over the hills, whether they were about to be crushed, whether they're about to be killed, what was going to happen next with the political situation. But God doesn't answer any of that. He just says to them, be strong, be encouraged, press on, be strong. In verse 4, then he says, work, just do the job that's in front of you. Work. He then says, and this is perhaps what they are longing to hear, I am with you. It's this that changes everything. The question of whether the army's coming or not coming, the question of the politics and what's going to change or what's not going to change, that isn't the key and the heart of what is important. What is important is that the God of heaven, the one who's created heaven and earth, speaks to this weak, small group of people. And he says, I am with you. I am with you. And then he says to them, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. You know, all of us are bound to be in the middle of some kind of story, just like the end of chapter 5 to chapter 6, where we have questions of what's going to happen and how's it going to resolve. But these people in this moment of uncertainty, they have this message from God. Be strong. Work. I am with you. Do not fear. And I need to hear that message. I need to hear it tonight. I need to hear it as we press on into tomorrow. Well, let's see then what happens. What happens into this situation of uncertainty? We turn back now to Ezra chapter 6. Ezra chapter 6, with those words of God ringing in our ears. Do you remember, they're wondering, are the chariots going to come? Is destruction just around the corner? What is going to happen next? Let's read from chapter 6, verse 1. King Darius then issued an order. This is miles away. King Darius then issued an order, and they searched in the archives stored in the treasury at Babylon. A scroll was found in the citadel of Ecbatana in the province of Media, and this was written on it. Memorandum. In the first year of King Cyrus, the king issued a decree concerning the temple of God in Jerusalem. Let the temple be rebuilt as a place to present sacrifices, and let its foundations be laid. He then describes what should happen as that building goes ahead. So this scroll has been found that proves that the people really do have the right to be doing what they're doing. The people are still carrying on what they're doing, even though they don't know what is going to happen next. But miles away, out of sight, in the corridors of power, this scroll has been found. And this letter continues, and it's addressed to the very people who've been opposing Ezra through these last chapters. Verse 6. Now then, Tattenai, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar-Bozenai, and you, their fellow officials of the province, stay away from there. Do not interfere with the work on this temple of God. Let the governor of the Jews and the Jewish elders rebuild this house of God on its site. Moreover, I hereby decree what you are to do for these elders of the Jews in the construction of this house of God. The expenses of these men are to be fully paid out of the royal treasury from the revenues of Trans-Euphrates, so that the work will not stop. Whatever is needed, young bulls, rams, male lambs for burnt offerings to the God of heaven, and wheat, salt, wine, and oil, as requested by the priests in Jerusalem, must be given them daily without fail, so that they may offer sacrifices pleasing to the God of heaven and pray for the well-being of the king and his sons. Let's stop there at verse 10. What a turnaround. Isn't it amazing? So the scroll is found and those meddlers are told to stay away. They're told also to pay the money for them to be able to carry on. Also to provide the animals for the sacrifices. And then it gets even more extreme. Verse 11. Furthermore, I decree that if anyone changes this edict, a beam is to be pulled from his house and he is to be lifted up and impaled on it. And for this crime, his house is to be made a pile of rubble. May God, who has caused his name to dwell there, overthrow any king or people who lifts a hand to change this decree or to destroy this temple in Jerusalem. I, Darius, have decreed it. Let it be carried out with diligence. That's verse 12. Isn't that amazing? So if anyone gets in the way of this job, then the instructions are, go to his house, pull out the main beam so that his house falls down, and then impale that person who got in way of the job on it so that he's dead and his house is destroyed. What a wonderful turnaround. From wondering whether the army's about to come to kill them, to finding out that the king wants to pay, and the king wants to provide the sacrifices, and the king is going to defend this work, even to the point of putting to death those who get in the way. Let's read verse 13. Then, because of the decree King Darius had sent, Tattenai, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethabozani and their associates carried it out with diligence. It's not surprising, is it? Isn't that wonderful? And then it describes how they continue to build and how Haggai and Zechariah continue to teach. In verse 16, this is what it says. Then the people of Israel, the priests, the Levites, and the rest of the exiles celebrated the dedication of the house of God with joy. The house of God is finished. The building work is complete. The temple is done. Their hearts are changed. They've turned back to God. There's been a spiritual revolution. And before they knew the king was going to be on their side, they were ready to lay down their lives. But now they realize that God has changed this king's heart too. And God's purpose of building a temple that would have a greater glory than the old one, because of what God was going to do in Jerusalem at the time of this new temple, well, it's been achieved. It's been complete. Then there's a list of this incredible and extravagant sacrifice that was made to dedicate the temple, and how in verse 18, the priests and the Levites took their places. What a wonderful story. What a wonderful account. A people on the brink of extermination, on the brink of extinction, and God uses these weak people to achieve his purposes. We're going to have the questions tonight at the very end, after we've broken bread together, and you'll see why, because of this next part and this last part of the passage. So let's now read verse 19 down to verse 22. On the 14th day of the first month, the exiles celebrated the Passover. The priests and Levites had purified themselves and were all ceremonially clean. The Levites slaughtered the Passover lamb for all the exiles, for their brothers, the priests, and for themselves. So the Israelites who had returned from the exile ate it, together with all who'd separated themselves from the unclean practices of their Gentile neighbors, in order to seek the Lord, the God of Israel. For 7 days they celebrated with joy the feast of unleavened bread, because the Lord had filled them with joy by changing the attitude of the king of Assyria, so that he assisted them in the work on the house of God, the God of Israel. Isn't that beautiful? So in verse 19, they celebrate the Passover. Now, for some of us, we might not be familiar with what happened at Passover. You see, years before, when they were in captivity, not in Babylon, but the time before in Egypt, there were a number of plagues. And then the last plague came. And God said, there's going to be judgment on every house. In every house, somebody is going to die. Something or someone is going to die in every house. He said, you can take a lamb and bring that into your home. And then you can slaughter that lamb. And then you take that lamb's blood and you put it on the crossways bit of your doorposts and put it on the up and down bits of your doorposts. And then the judgment won't come into your house. It will pass over your house. And now here they are, a people who deserved judgment, but they've been brought back from Babylon. They've been rescued back from Babylon. And they are celebrating this Passover feast. It says that they separated themselves. They decided not to live any longer in the same way that the people around them lived. Again, an echo of our study this morning. And they separated themselves because they wanted to seek the Lord, to seek him, to thirst after him. It says that really their lives, as they separated themselves to seek, were marked with joy. And that the nation really was changed. Their situation was transformed. It was turned around because of God's intervention. And of course, this is an echo of our own story, isn't it? And right in front of us, we have this bread and this wine. And Jesus, he was killed. Many of you be so familiar with this, but some of us may never have known that Jesus was killed at Passover time, years later after this Passover. And his blood, well, it wasn't put onto the crossways bit of a doorpost and the up and down bit of a doorpost so that the judgment would pass. Instead, it was poured out on a cross where Jesus died for us, so that the punishment would pass us over, so that we would not receive the punishment that we deserve. So we're going to go straight to break this bread and share this wine together. But perhaps before we do, just two of us could loudly from your seat just lead us in prayers of thanks to the Lord Jesus who has died for us so that the punishment would pass over. The one who died, the Passover lamb, the one who died in our place. Perhaps two of us could lead us in prayer.